Good morning, everybody, and welcome back here to the Mark Steiner Show on your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA 80.9 FM, the voice of the community. We have been trying to bring you these conversations between people running for the city council, not necessarily ones who are running against one another in a certain district, but just hearing the voices of people who are running to give you a sense of what they stand for, who you should vote for. Do you agree with their ideas? Dialogue with them about their ideas, about where we're going. There's so much that faces our city. We've seen the debates we've had on this program and around the city on Port Covington that was just passed by the city council. We've seen the issues of crime in our city, which in some places is really growing. The question is, what is our response to that? What should our city's role be in our schools? And more. And so we want your ideas and thoughts at 410-319-8888. You can also log on to our Facebook pages. You can tweet us at Mark Steiner. Send me an email to talk@steinershow.org. We're here in the studio with Dan Spiracco, independent running in District 12. Good to have you in the studio, Dan.
Thank you, Mark.
Shannon Sneed, Democrat running in District 13. Good to have you as always, Shannon. Good to see you again.
Good morning. Thank you.
And welcome back to Ryan Dorsey, Democrat running in District 3. Good to have you here, Ryan.
Thank you very much.
And you all can join us here at 410-319-8888. We do want to hear your ideas about where this is going. So let me just begin here. We covered and had, I think, a role to play in the discussions that took place around Port Covington and Sagamore and the development of Port Covington. And there's still a lot of controversy, even though it was passed by the Baltimore City Council. So I'm curious at your ideas. All three of you want to sit on this council. And if you had been there now, I'm curious how you may have voted. And B, if you're satisfied with this Port Covington deal. And if not, why not? Ryan, go ahead. Ryan Dorsey.
I don't know of an action in living memory that further perpetuates, that more greatly perpetuates racial segregation in Baltimore City. I don't know of anything that throws greater caution to the wind about the welfare of education in Baltimore City. I, throughout my primary campaign, was adamant that I will not support any kind of tax breaks or incentives for inner harbor development, waterfront development, without similar investments being made in communities outside of the harbor area. I, as a council person, intend to work more proactively than reactively in the way the current council has worked. And, you know, I think it's an imperative for us to push a standard for community benefits agreements for whatever the next TIF, the next request of this kind of magnitude that comes along for the city. We have to have standards so that people aren't just coming to the city with the expectation that we're going to throw caution to the wind. You know, these people have to come not just with a single bottom line, but a double bottom line that ensures real social benefit to things that the city is helping with, things that we are a city in dire straits in a lot of ways. We have to expect corporate partners to be what the citizens of Baltimore City deserve.
Shannon Sneed.
So when on the surface, when you hear this project is coming, and you if you've seen any of the videos, you're like, oh wow, but the bottom line is, I always think you have to look at what's in black and white. And so for me, in our community, I've knocked on doors, you know, we've heard right from the constituents, and that's what matters to us. That will there be jobs, will there be you know, can someone get an apprenticeship? Will there be careers out of this? In the past, we have been promised that in the past, that folks will have good careers. They'll be working. It'll be a great place. And it really doesn't pan out to be that. And so from everything that they've put out there, you're still unsure. It's more of talking points when you read about the Baltimore Sun or when you look at the MOU. It's like, You really don't know unless you sit in a room, if you've been in negotiations with them. So for someone like me who hasn't sat at the table, who hasn't heard firsthand what's going to happen, I have no idea. But I think that the city and its residents should always benefit from a project as large as this. if it's going to come here, because we have so many issues in District 13 that are unlike District 3, that are unlike District 1. We have really people hurting that's living below the poverty line in my district. And so I think education is a huge piece of what's going to make my district better. And I feel like as residents in Baltimore City government, we have to put our money where our mouth is and invest in education. Like, we know the formula, we've heard it over and over again, but we don't do it. So I know that was a lot in one, but the bottom line is it's all interconnected. We want to see Baltimore grow, we want to see better transit, we want to see jobs. We don't want to not have businesses in Baltimore City. I totally get it. You know, when businesses come, people are working, but we want to make sure that everyone is thriving and working and growing in Baltimore City.
So before I turn to you, glasses falling. Sorry about that, guys. and listeners. So before I move over to Dan, I take it. Your vote would have been no had it come down to where it is now and you couldn't change the deal.
Well, I would like to have everyone come to the table, and I probably would. So right on the surface from what I know about it, yes. No, I want to see more. I want to make sure that it's just not something that a group of people will benefit from, but that everyone will benefit from to make Baltimore City better. And so that's sitting down with MTA, that's sitting down with some of our partners in the nonprofit world. It would be a whole cohesive group sitting down to make sure that it benefits everyone, and not just you sitting down with me and you sitting down with Ryan and then you sitting down with nonprofit. And I think that's kind of sort of seemed like how it worked when you looked at the when you read different articles. But again, I'm not in the room, I don't know.
So I think you're saying you would have voted no.
As
the deal was constructed in the end.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, our council needs to, for the future, with me, take a more proactive role in working with the enormous outcry of the advocacy community. Not just community, but it's communities plural, because we had jobs advocates out there, particularly with the labor unions, and the housing advocates, particularly through the Baltimore Housing Roundtable, and the work that's done through Lawrence Brown and Brace and that whole community, furthering that dialogue. Have to be leaders on that. We need to be the advocates of the community.
I want to go with Dan. Yes, I'm sorry.
I agree with that. And I think had we been there to have this vote, the three of us would have been part of a coalition of people that would have been setting the table for everything that's happened since April 2015. So if you look at the two big things that have happened since April 2015 and since young people hit the streets and explained to us how dissatisfied they are with the direction of the city, what have been the responses? Well, first, we had Port Covington. Second, we had the governor come in with his Project CORE and say we're going to demolish a lot of buildings. And for a lot of us, that's not enough of a response. And many of us have been waiting for a real response to what happened in April 2015. I was in the mayor's office at the time, and I pushed for a response for months and months and either quit or was fired, depending on who you asked, because I asked a little too stridently.
What did you do in the mayor's office when you were there then?
Well, I was assistant deputy mayor for operations. So we were the meat and potatoes of city government: trash, water, sewer, transportation. But after April 2015, you know, the entire city government is on emergency. You know, the city of Baltimore is on the cover of the New York Times on a daily basis. People are talking about Baltimore. This is you. This is your history. This is your city. What are you going to do? And as we looked around, what became very clear from our federal partners, from the network of people who are supposed to have answers to this, what was very clear is that we have no answer for Sandtown Winchester.
So I want to come back to the
and we need to have one.
And I want to get back to what these answers are from your perspectives. I mean, because clearly there are going to be new blood on the city council, whether you three are members or not in your districts. Someone's going to represent. So we're going to have, eight new people on the council?
Yes.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
There'll be eight new members, which is significant in terms of change that could happen, even though the council, we'll talk about in a moment, itself, at least the people who are no longer going to be on the council, voted the majority, to not give the city council members more power in the budget, which I thought was an interesting thing. I wanted to get to that as well. Let's go to the phones first. 410-319-8888. Gary, you're on the air. Welcome.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call, Mark. And kudos to your guests. All three of them appear to be people that I could agree with on the overwhelming variety of topics that face us at this very crucial time. As I was walking, the phrase, you know, came to me that I can walk and chew gum at the same time. And even though this Port Covington thing is extremely disheartening, and as your first guest said, just a continuation of gentrification and the polarization of the strata of society here, it's just so important for us to be able to do, you know, I mean, I'm sorry, but you guys are going to have to be everything to all the people all the time if you come in and get that spot on the city council. You know, we got to stop this government for corporations as soon as we possibly can. And in closing, I just simply want to say, you know, we got to have clean air, soil, and water.
Okay.
And that each one of us is connected to everybody else in this whole plan. I'll take your comments off the air.
All right. Well, thanks so much, Gary. And 410-319-8888 comes to these calls. We want to get your ideas and thoughts for these three people who would be your next city council representatives: Dan Spiracco, District 12; Shannon Sneed, Democrat, District 13; Ryan Dorsey, Democrat, running in District 3. We have a lot we're facing in the city. City council has some power, but not as the very strong mayoral system. So, I mean, what are your agendas going to be? In other words, let's take the issue of how the budget is parsed out, and the police department has the lion's share of the city budget. So how should that change? And when we look at public safety, what are your original ideas, if you have any? And that, I don't mean that as a pejorative thing. That didn't come out right. What would be your original ideas about how to deal with public safety in ways we are not doing it now? How do we confront the problem of violence in our communities? How do we confront the issue of robberies going up and carjackings going up? Is the police the way we respond all the time, Shannon Sneed? Are there other ways for us to begin to look at this? Then we'll go right back to you, Dan. I'm sorry.
So, and that's the key. So murders are up, crime is up. I think District 9 right now has the most of homicides. And so District 13 is like right behind them when it comes to that. And so it's something that we ponder all the time. And I still say that, it goes back to making sure that we're producing good citizens, making sure that we're putting money in the education system, making sure that we have a relationship with our police department, make sure, because I don't believe that putting all this money in the police department, we're getting results that we want. And so that's not the case. We got to make sure that our kids are growing up, they can work, and that they can go to school, and that they can, you know, become these great positive citizens that will make a difference in our communities. But we need both halves to come together. So, and it's not, to me, I feel like it's not rocket science. We've tried it all other ways, but we haven't said enough already with pouring money into the police department. Let's pour money into education. Let's pour money into the other side of it, so we don't have to put all that money into incarceration and ex-offenders and all of that. I just believe we start on the front end. So that's how I look at it.
Dan?
Well,
I
couldn't agree more. And I think actually I'm disappointed that yesterday news came out that that the current administration is going to be asking for more money from the state to implement these reforms. And I said all along, the reforms called for by the Department of Justice, if we are not, we don't need more, we need different. We spent $500 million a year last year almost on police. We have 3,000 sworn officers, and yet the Eastern District that covers the vast majority of my district, the 12th, has 13 officers on shift on a Saturday night. There's something basically wrong with that calculation. Now, we really underestimate the power that the council has, and this makes me a bit of a wonk in this regard. When we look at the structure of our government and how we spend, like the big question now going forward, and as we come to the end of what we've all experienced as a drug war, and we start looking at a lot of crime issues as public health issues. And we start looking at the structure of our government. How much of what the police does now should be handled by the health department? And this goes to the structure of our government that the city council controls, because the city council controls the city charter. And there's a lot of things that we have a government that was last structured in 1960 for a city that is a fundamentally different place than it is now. And when we look at police and when we look at the way we solve these problems, it is our responsibility to structure that government. The real issue actually is not power so much between council and mayor. It's between city and state. Like, we need to get control of our destiny again. We don't really control our police department. We don't really control our school system. And what we need authority to reform our police department. That's what we're going to run into with this Department of Justice report. We're going to discover that between state law and union contracts, we're not able to do the things that we really need to do to make the department more efficient and better, and empower officers who are there every day trying to do a good job.
So, Ryan, one of the things I thought about as you were speaking, Ryan Dorsey, as Dan was speaking, is that so if you take institutions back, that also means money. That means we're going to come up with the money to pay for it.
Right. For me, the key here with the police department is divestment of racist institutional structures, white supremacist structures like the Baltimore City Police Department, as kind of shaped by the FOP. Understanding how the FOP has had a real heavy hand in making things what they are, and working as a city council to push back on their sway. The key is not necessarily, obviously this heavy investment in the police department is not working to reduce crime rates, although the 3rd District has the lowest homicide rates of any district in the city consistently. Last year, while homicide rates in the city and in the police district within the 3rd District were exceeding record numbers, we had only 5 in the 3rd District, not one more than the previous year, and that's the lowest of any district in the city. Right now, we've only seen 3 in the whole city, in the district, and I think that's because of the quality of life. And these are things that other policy solutions can impact. These are the things that I have campaigned on: equitable housing, transit, and employment opportunity for everybody in Baltimore City. Fair housing. It's affordable in areas of opportunity with access to decent schools and decent transit access and jobs, bolstering livable streets in communities that can support safe pedestrian traffic, cyclists, not just automotive traffic for county residents coming in and out of downtown jobs. We need to start thinking about how our communities are built to benefit people here in Baltimore City. And when people are able to thrive in their communities, there will be less of a cause for such heavy policing. I'm kind of tired of just discussion after discussion about community policing. We need to talk about more livable communities in the first place.
Let me open the phones here, because it goes right to the heart of the $30 million that this morning Mayor Stephanie Rawlings-Blake is asking the state to give to respond to the Department of Justice report to restructure the police department. There should be, I guess, community discussion about is it just about restructuring, is what you were saying? Is it something deeper than just restructuring the police that we have to deal with? What do our listeners think? 410-319-8888. Leo, you're on the air. Welcome.
Good morning, Mark Steiner.
Good morning, Leo Burrows. How are you?
I'm great. Good morning to you and all your guests. Let me briefly say that I think Mayor Stephanie Rawlings-Blake has been a disaster to us. She's acted in ways in steamrolling this Port Covington deal that is emblematic, symptomatic of, and reflective of the fact that she works for the Greater Baltimore Committee. In my judgment, I'm not sure that the death knell hasn't already been sounded with $660 million or $1 billion in this Port Covington agreement. What it has not done, ladies and gentlemen, what it has not done is tell us how many apprenticeship job slots are available for those who are well-educated enough and able to read and write so that they can get out of poverty. I want to see people, organizers, out on street corners, Pennsylvania Avenue and North Avenue notwithstanding, street corners where we're saying to folks, if you meet certain requirements, there are job slots available for you, and you can get paid while you're being trained in the construction field, et cetera. And I would remind you that with regard to the TIFs, there has been every indication, if we go back and look at the records, that the majority of people working for TIF projects, which have been assigned to billionaires, have been Hispanics and white folks. Black men have been less than 10% of the workforce. And so we're given no guarantees as to the employment of black people in a majority black city. So I'm terribly disappointed. And let me conclude on this note, Mark. Do you know Mr. Edward Scott, the candidate for city council, the 7th city council district? He's an independent in this city. President of Uchima People's Progress Party.
Oh, yeah, right.
I hope you get him on your
He's
show.
He's been here. He'll
he
be back.
He's already been on there.
He's been on, but
he
he'll
has
be
been
back.
On.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, good luck to all of you, but I'm saying you should have spoken out with more vigor before this Port Covington disaster was ratified. I didn't hear enough candidates for office speaking out against it because it's going to be, it's absolutely disastrous at this juncture. Thank you.
Thank you. I would like to probably delve in one day soon to find out if the statistics you threw out, Leo, are right about just 10% of the workers in these projects being African-American men. I don't know if that's true, real or not, but I would certainly, it'd be interesting to know.
I hear it all the time. I mean, when I walk the streets and I talk to people, like I hear that concern a lot. You know, I think the pipeline to get to jobs, I think, is very difficult. I think for a lot of folks who are living in economically isolated neighborhoods, it is hard. And we have a mix of government agencies and nonprofits trying to get people training and jobs. I encountered a guy who's a small businessman, a contractor in Darley Park, who is one of the few minority contractors for BGE to do underground work. And he says, look, if you gave me the money, I would train people myself. I would create apprenticeships in my own business because I need to find workers. I'm always looking, and this is a black man. He wants to hire people from his own neighborhood, and he has a hard time doing it because he needs skilled workers, and he doesn't have the resources himself to train them. So the opportunity is there. You know, to me, in terms of Port Covington, I never answered your question. My main issue with Port Covington is that it has basically sucked the air out of the room to talk about the other neighborhoods we need to be talking about. And what my bottom line with this is that if that deal can hold the city harmless from the perspective of if it's a net positive for the city, if we are not out of pocket, my major concern with that was school funding, and I don't have a clear answer on school funding yet. But if we're held harmless and it's a net positive in terms of tax revenue, I wouldn't have had a problem with it.
I mean, I think the issues Leo raised are really important. I think the skill issue is huge in the city for young men and women in the city not being able to have the skills to do the jobs that we need. And also Port Covington, just a final thought as we go to break here and come right back for our three guests, is that the way I look at Port Covington is that we are seeing our dystopian future in front of us,
mm-hmm.
in terms of what's being developed in our city.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I think that, as Lawrence Brown says in his program all the time, it's the white L and the black butterfly. And that analysis is really interesting. And I think that's something we have to really, we're just right in front of us. We just seem to just get, it just.
We're laying the groundwork for the next Fred Gray.
Right.
Well, and it's disturbing, actually, because you can see these major institutions detaching from the city. You have Hopkins East and West. You have Maryland, the Biopark. Now you have Hopkins. Kevin Plank, Port Covington. Even in the north, in Morgan, you have these large institutions that need the future of the city. And either the city's going to unify, or these folks are going to say, look, we're anchor institutions. Either we have a functioning government and a functioning city, or we will cut off and go our own way. And that's where we're headed, unfortunately.
We'll take a short break, come back, and hear what Shannon has to say about all this. Shannon Sneed. We're here with three people who are running for city council. Shannon Sneed, Ryan Dorsey, Dan Spiracco, and you at 410-319-8888. Will, you're the next caller up. We're going to come to your call with your question about the FOP. Stay with us. Don't go away. Welcome back, folks. Good to have you with us here on the Mark Steiner Show as we continue our conversation with people who would be your next city council representatives here in the city of Baltimore. These are not debates. These are discussions between people and you about what they would do if they were on the city council. On the way back to that, I want to remind you, the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you in part by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, offering a full range of financial services. MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. More information at www.mecu.com or at steinershow.org is MeQ, Baltimore Credit Union's banner. And our guests are Shannon Sneed, Democrat running in District 13, Ryan Dorsey, Democrat running in District 3, and Dan Spiracco, Independent running in District 12. And you all at 410-319-8888. And Will, welcome to the program. What's your thought?
Good morning. Thank you and your guest as well. Two quick points. One, the FOP, more powerful than the city council, in my opinion, at this point in time, because they yield around this power so they can keep their police intact doing what they want them to do. And at the end of the day, it's all about money and the pensions that they have and they want to keep. I would love to see the new city council try to strip them of some of their power and hopefully use the Department of Justice report to do that. The other point I want to make in regards to trying to bring Baltimore back to what it should be is the simple fact that gentrification is needed to a certain point. If we are to try to bring back Baltimore as a whole, when you look at the what the Maryland Institute College of Art is doing just in the Howard Street Bridge, North Avenue area, and how they're turning that community around slowly but surely, and as well as Charles Street, North Charles Station, Station North, you have to look at this and see, you know, that this is some of what it's going to take to bring the city back to what it should be. And I'd just like to hear the comments from your guests on that.
So I'm going to jump in really quickly and say that I agree partly with it, but especially with the housing piece. But it still has to be affordable, I say. And it still has to be, it can't be all market rate, because then you'll drive people like me who don't make a lot of money out of the city. So I think in order to make or want people to come back, you got to make sure that, one, it's affordable; two, that just the basic quality, the quality of living, quality of needs, that it's clean, that it's green, that we have the correct transportation, that it comes on time. It's just multiple parts in just, you know, coming back to Baltimore City. We got to make sure that the schools are good, that families want to stay, that they want to come back, and else we're not going to do anything. And if crime is up, we're not going to get anyone to invest in it. And so it's a whole bunch of different moving parts that play a huge role in making our neighborhoods better. And if we don't take ownership of it ourselves, for the folks who are still there, then we'll lose it. I mean, we just have to not allow to not give up, to, you know, and think about the plan after the fact. I was just at a community meeting, and this guy, man, said, you know, my family is retiring, my folks are old, so I bought their home so the home wouldn't go into disarray. Because what's happening is folks are dying off, and then they leave their home to someone, and then it goes into disarray. The roof falls in. Everything imaginably happens, and then you're stuck. The neighbor who lives next door is stuck with this abandoned home next to them that's ruining their home. So it's just a lot of moving parts. It's just not that easy, because I feel like if it was that easy, it would have been done already.
So it's picking up on that, Ryan, before I turn back to Dan, Ryan Dorsey, I mean, so and I've asked this question numerous times to a number of people. So what is then the economic model that allows you to address that problem in our city? I mean, so we say gentrification, is it good, is it bad? And have this legitimate argument. So when you have, as we had here, houses collapsing all the time in Baltimore, that they're full of lead paint, the gentleman whose name I'm blocking at the moment, who was killed as he sat in his Cadillac because the car fell on him in Sandtown. So, I mean, so what is the model that allows for a different kind of development? I mean, how do you envision that? What would you fight for, whether you had the power to make those changes immediately or not?
Well, we have Question J coming up on the ballot in November.
We need to have that discussion on the show. Question J, that's what I was trying to think of this morning. Question J, right.
Yeah. So I've been supportive of Question J. In fact, I have volunteers in my district.
Why don't you describe Question J for our listeners?
Sure.
I don't know what that is yet.
Question J is a ballot initiative that was put on by gathering 18,000 signatures around Baltimore City for a charter amendment to create an affordable housing trust fund for Baltimore City. It doesn't say that we're necessarily going to put money in it. It just says here's a place where we can put money, and it can come from basically anywhere. And it gives the council power to put money there, where, as you mentioned before, the council having very limited power in budgeting, this actually creates the opportunity for the council to put money there by ordinance. And it also creates a 12-member board of oversight. The fund would be administered by the housing office in Baltimore City, but have a 12-person board of oversight for it to make sure that that money is being used for its intended purpose of promoting housing affordability and housing inclusivity. And those 12 slots appointed by the mayor actually have specific designations, like somebody who is or has been the recipient of some sort of housing voucher, like a housing choice voucher, a renter in Baltimore City whose household makes below 35% of the median income, somebody experienced in the field of affordable housing lending, a homeowner who makes 50% of median income or less. And I think this is an important tool. And we need all the tools that we can get in the tool shed right now in Baltimore City to promote housing affordability and inclusivity and neighborhood diversity. At the state level, we got to support acts like what we just saw in Baltimore County, the HOME Act. That's a big issue for Baltimore City that needs to be pushed in Baltimore County. We need to see that pushed at the state level. That's all about non-discrimination of source of income when it comes to housing. These are important issues for us to push. So I've got volunteers today applying vote yes question J labels onto all of my leftover primary campaign literature so that all of my efforts throughout the rest of this campaign are going to be about door knocking in neighborhoods here to push question J.
Dan Sirocco.
Well, in terms of investment, I look at it this way. So every Sunday morning, the population of East Baltimore doubles. Because every Sunday morning, people come in from the county to go to church in neighborhoods where they used to live, but moved out a long time ago to move to Randallstown, to move to Owings Mills. So when I think of investment and when I think of gentrification, see, a lot of people think of gentrification. They think white people moving into a black neighborhood and getting rid of all the black people. We need working people to move back into the neighborhoods that they left. And when I walk through Oliver and I walk through Broadway East and I knock on a door and I encounter a young family, they're black, they got a couple kids, and we have a conversation. And they say, my husband's family's from here, so we decided to buy a house. One of us works at Hopkins. Maybe we got one of those subsidies from Hopkins to move in here. When we think of gentrification, which in my view is a distraction in this city, our problem is not gentrification. Our problem is large pockets of concentrated poverty and low-income neighborhoods that are economically isolated. And my answer to that is actually to identify neighborhoods that have a high number of vacant buildings. Because exactly what Shannon was just talking about, I've encountered that over and over again. I knock on the door of a woman who's 85 years old. Her neighbor's down the street. She says, don't knock on those doors because all those people have now moved on. They've either passed away or they've moved to a nursing home and the family can't afford to keep up the house. And those houses are all going to fall into disrepair. My answer to that is to create a tax break for neighborhoods that have a high number of vacants to reduce their tax rate on residential structures to 1.1%.
So what does that mean, though, practically? So how do you do that?
It's just legislation. We set our tax rate.
So someone owns that house and are living there, or there's an absentee landlord who has a house and doesn't take care of it, or it's a family member who inherited a house but either can't afford to take care of it, doesn't have the wherewithal. So what does that do for them, and what does that do for that family? What does it do for the neighborhood, and how do you get that house to change?
Well, if we reduce the cost of ownership, and I'm looking for tools as a council person that we can give to people. And if we reduce the cost of ownership, and we combine that with some low interest or zero interest, we create a loan fund to let people maintain homes. So actually, when grandma moves on, someone can take over the house. I encountered a guy in Madison Park who said, "You know what? This house was my family's house 30 years ago, and then my sister inherited it, and then she lost it, and it was vacant. I came back, and I found the house, and I bought it, and I renovated it because it's my house, and this is my neighborhood, and this was important to me." And if we can get 500 people a year to do that in East Baltimore, and we can incentivize them to come back, that's over 5 years, we could fundamentally change most of these neighborhoods.
So if we have a city, which we do, where at least 91,000 households, not people, households, do not know how they're going to pay their rent or what they're going to use the money for at the end of the month or beginning of the month. I mean, so I think it's important to do what you're saying, but I'm that's one of the reasons that I had so many issues with Port Covington. If our policies don't affect the poor working class people of the city, the majority of African Americans in this town who live and struggle every day to survive, then what good are the damn policies? I mean, how do we begin to do that? I mean, what do we do to?
I mean, I campaigned with a pledge to introduce legislation to increase the minimum wage to at least $15 an hour, at the forefront of my campaign, putting more money in the hands of working class people, directly putting money in the hands of working class people in Baltimore City is absolutely essential.
So how do you do that? How do you put the money directly in the hands of working class people?
We have tens of thousands of people working in Baltimore City below a livable wage, particularly in major institutions that are part of this nonprofit industrial complex, the hospitals, the healthcare institutions, the schools that are paying very little in taxes based on the assumption that they're of benefit to the community, that they're job creators. Well, if they're only creating jobs for wealthy people who don't live in Baltimore City, mm-hmm. or for poor working class people who are struggling to live in Baltimore City. Look, and it's not a part of putting money in people's hands is just being able to get to and from their home and work. That's why I stress transit so heavily, that if people can't get to their job, they're going to lose it. And if they can't get to their job and they lose that, they're going to lose their home too. And the people that are struggling the most are the people that are making the least.
I think sometimes in the black community, it's having financial literacy, because you know how much you bring home every month, and so you know what you can and you cannot do. And sometimes we do have to watch what we do and how we spend money. So I always think it's having a vision and having a plan, writing it down and working towards that goal. And so how do we do it? I don't look for folks to give me anything, but I work to look for opportunities where I can get assistance, where I can get help, because I think Baltimore City has a plethora of programs that can help folks do different things. We have Youth Works program that will help the youth get a job, get those soft skills. And I think things like that in the beginning of a young person's career makes a difference of when they grow up. How do you handle your money? When I have youth work students in the summertime, it's, hey, what are you going to do with your paycheck this month? Some of them say, as soon as I get my paycheck, I'm going to go shopping, I'm spending. And I'm like, well, how much are you saving? And so that kind of thing makes a difference, that we need to have those conversations with our young people. And to me, that should be implemented in school. About the whole total financial literacy piece, it's missing.
And it is important. It really is critical. I think that's an important piece. All these are important. Let me go back to the phones here and also read this tweet coming in. America, the next caller up, we're going to come to your call. Melissa Schober tweets in, do any of the candidates support a higher property tax on vacant structures? Vacant structures.
Yes. Yeah. I would. D.C. has something similar to it about vacant property sitting in there. We talked about it with other Democrats that are coming in about the same thing. It was in my notes beforehand about vacant properties. Because some of the people don't live in Baltimore City. So if you do a real property search, you'll find that folks are in, like, Virginia. They're in, over.
And the main obstacle has been the fact that the city already owns so many structures and so much vacants that, frankly, the city doesn't want to own any more of them, mm-hmm. because they don't want to manage them. But that, to me, is a resource issue. That's not a good reason to not do it, because we want to take this land from people who are mismanaging or not managing it and figure out how to make better use of it.
So you're saying, yes, higher property taxes
on vacation. Absolutely, yeah, no problem with
that. Ryan?
Also with his disparate communities in Baltimore City, it's a more effective tool in some neighborhoods than it is in others. The housing department, the code enforcement, already discriminates in how they apply fines and citations to properties, because just some properties, it's ineffective in a neighborhood that's completely disinvested. It creates no leverage to improve the property by placing a fine on it. It only further encourages.
What was my vacants?
Yeah, which we have thousands, tens of thousands of in Baltimore City. So, of course, it could be a useful tool.
Let's go back to the phones at 410-319-8888. Merrick, you're on the air. Welcome.
Good morning, all. Good morning. I wanted to ask a question about the Baltimore Link. In hearing a representative from that project, he said that the idea was to move residents to where the jobs were, to make sure people get to their jobs, which are out in the county, right, which is what he said. And so in my head, that plays out, oh, you're trying to get the folks who have to take these low-wage jobs to their low-wage jobs in the county. And subsequently, because I don't personally – the way that the link was presented to me seemed really kind of crazy and not effective. For me, it is a way to push low income or income distressed people out into the counties and speed up gentrification. So I wanted to know what you thought about Baltimore Link and how can we bring good paying jobs to Baltimore City instead of driving people out of the city because the jobs aren't here. Thank you very much.
Ryan Dorsey.
Baltimore Link is not the fix for our transit problems in Baltimore City. We need to adopt a Vision Zero policy that says that pedestrians, people should not be dying because of car traffic. We need to emphasize other modes of transit like cycling. I'm glad to see the Maryland Avenue cycle track being installed now, creating opportunities for mobility for people who don't own cars. Baltimore City has a very high reliance rate on public transit. It's true. I was glad to see some tickets actually being handed out yesterday on the Pratt Street.
The new bus track.
Yeah, the new bus track there.
Tickets to cars who are using the bus track?
Yeah, they've been driving in the bright red painted bus lane since the day it was painted.
That's right.
So we have to change the car culture here. And part of that is going to be rethinking how we design roads for equity. Complete streets is a primary focus for me. I intend to put forth legislation for complete streets to develop a more equitable transit environment for everybody in Baltimore City.
Any other additional
thoughts? So I was going to those meetings and Raisin came there because at the beginning I didn't think they were getting what we were saying. As a bus rider, you want to improve the city, improve the MTA, you want to improve transportation. And I feel like we have to start somewhere. So when they went back and did some of the recommendations that we suggested, I felt like, okay, this is a little better. But still, it still goes back to being reliable, being able to, accommodate our students and our folks that are getting to work. I was in Pittsburgh, and they have the same exact quick bus, their own roads, and it was good. I got to where I needed to get to, but here, unless people follow the rules of staying out those red lines and really making sure that the buses come to every neighborhood, that it is serving the right routes, then we're still going to be in the same predicament.
There was a person on this program 20 years ago, I think it was, maybe longer, from the Manhattan Institute in New York, which is a conservative urban think tank, that actually have some good ideas when it comes to, and I think they didn't throw out their ideas just because they're conservative. They have some good ideas. One of their ideas was to build on the entrepreneurial spirit of people in the community, of allowing people to have a van inspected, or whatever that transportation thing, and use the bus stops to pick people up and take them to and from work.
Well, we have that, or we have.
It's called a hack.
A hack, yeah. Yes. I'm going to say my family hack. My uncles make money because they hacked.
Right.
I was like, when Uber came about, I was like, well, we've been doing that in my family forever. Like, my uncles hacked.
Just don't have an app.
They just don't have an app, but it's the old, you call
get
your
in
hack.
The van.
Right.
Yes.
But get that's in the van. See that?
What?
So.
Get in the van.
We need the opposite answer, actually. I mean, we're the only city that isn't served by a functional regional transit authority that has the actual riders' interests at heart. We have MTA, which is the unloved stepchild within a much larger state department of transportation, who doesn't pay a lot of attention to the MTA. And we're not. This is another example where we're a city that doesn't control our own destiny. And if we had a solution where we were under more control, where the riders had a say under an authority structure, then you could have a system that wasn't managed by people from down in Annapolis who have other concerns and other interests at heart. But there's no question, you know, there are a lot of jobs in the county, and we need regional solutions. So I would push back a little bit on the caller. I don't think we need to ship people out because we want to gentrify the rest of Baltimore. There are jobs in the county. Our main problem and my main concern with the minimum wage debate is that our people need to get that money and they need to get to those jobs. And if they cannot get to those jobs, someone from the county with a car will. The kid who's delivering pizza for $10 an hour in the county is going to take his parents' car and drive another 10 minutes across the county line and do it for $15 an hour here in the city if we don't figure out a way to get people to jobs. And so that is critical, wherever those jobs are. We've structured a region that basically has put exactly the people you're talking about, Mark, the 90,000 folks who are mostly black, who are working poor folks, they have
households.
Been isolated. Households. So even more people. So they've been put in a place where it's very hard to get to work, where the bus system doesn't work, and that requires a regional approach.
But it's so to me the whole, because that's what people, and I have to remember when we were canvassing and knocking on doors, speaking with residents, when someone asks me what's the number one concern in your district, it's always jobs. Like, I want a job. I used to work here. But we got to make sure that folks are ready and prepared for jobs.
Yes.
And I think that sometimes that while, you know, we want the job, a technology piece is a big part of it. In my district, a lot of folks don't have computers in their home, so they cannot apply for a job from their home, or they're not technically savvy with computers. So that's where I say education and apprenticeships make such a huge difference. It would benefit my community. And then I think that sometimes we don't even support the small businesses that we have in our communities. I mean, when I look at Monument Street and Bellary Road, there are so many vacant stores along those main streets. How do we get businesses in there? And then how do we support those businesses? You know, how do we let them know that you can get a small grant to open up a business? You know, that information needs to be, I believe, out there. And I don't think people know enough to go ahead and do it, because we want it. We know you could hire one or two people and have a small business, but we got to make sure when the businesses open up, we support it and we go there. So we necessarily don't go to the Walmart, but we go right in our communities.
We have to build even more livable communities. 30% of households in Baltimore City do not own cars. We have basically three times the rate of public transportation reliance of the national rate here in Baltimore City. And two-thirds of our daily workforce in Baltimore City is non-city residents. And two-thirds of our daily workforce is coming to their jobs in cars with no other passenger in them. If we simply build better communities that are more livable, more sustainable for people to live in them and work in them and get between them by modes other than car travel, we will see a stronger local economy. And I don't buy that county residents are just going to come in and get jobs, because we actually have well-paying jobs here in the city. Code enforcement can't hire people fast enough, and those are decent-paying jobs, and the county residents are not pouring in here to get them.
Finish with you anyway. No, okay. I don't want to stop you.
That's okay.
People will kill me for probably saying this, but I do think that if you work for Baltimore City, you should live in Baltimore City. I do think it would be great to see some legislation that points to that.
Well, what happens if the county says the same thing and then Baltimore City people can't get jobs?
But how many? I would say how many are working in Baltimore County? I would say that there, if you're making a certain amount of money or some way, we got it, because that's the number one thing too that you hear. Well, you know, they don't live in a city. You get to reap the benefits or some type of commuter tax or something, because I do feel like as a Baltimore City employee, imagine if all the people who actually lived in the city, who worked in the city, lived in the city. How many homes would be occupied? How much more taxes would be coming in? But the bottom line is, if you're working for Baltimore City, but you're living in Harford County, on weekends, you're not coming back into Baltimore City spending your paycheck a lot of times.
And it's that's actually, if you just ask your average Baltimore City employee, say, well, why don't you live here? And you had a round table with those folks, you'd have a pretty good template of all the things that need to be changed about our government and how it works, because they know intimately. And unfortunately, yes, way too many of them, they're living in Frederick, they're living in the county, and they're not, you know, and for reasons that a lot of times it's schools, you know, and a lot of times people say, I can't make the math work. I can't afford a private school. Yeah. I can't afford a house in a neighborhood that has a good public school. And so I'm going to move to the county. I want to push back on that because I want them living here. But it's a worthwhile conversation. It's a roadmap to reform right there.
Ron?
I think that's absolutely right. There's no shortage of problems here in Baltimore City. And the county residents, especially if you read the comments section on the Baltimore Sun,
which I don't,
they're pretty quick to tell you what they are.
No, I think that to me, it's really good to have the three of you here on the air with us, because I think that one of the most exciting things, I'll just throw this out here, one of the most exciting things to me about this particular race has not been the mayor's race, but has been the race for city council.
You think?
To me, because I think there's an energy and a youthfulness and people running, new ideas, new thoughts, which I think the three of you in different ways represent, that I think is really important that we need to have for the future. I mean, you are, to me, the future of the city. You're the people in your 30s, 20s who are trying to make a difference and trying to say, I want to step up and do it. I think that's really critically important. Yeah. You know, and I think that's why I say the city council races to me have been much more exciting than the mayor's race, it was exciting on some levels, but I mean, I think
mostly it was just stressful.
but I think this is, it's really good. And the fact that you all really want to serve.
Yeah, and I do have to say that we are not far thinking from each other. I think a lot of times we're like-minded people, and so I think how we get there, our paths to get to the end result, because a lot of us are for affordable housing, we are for jobs, there's no argument there. It's just that how do we propose to get there? Well, probably where we are like screaming and yelling at each other.
I have to jump in because we're out of time, and that was Shannon Sneed, who is Democrat running in District 13. Ryan Dorsey, Democrat running in District 3, which includes Morgan State University.
Absolutely. Glad to be in the district.
Dan Sparacco, who is independent running in District 12.
Thank you.
Mr. Carl Stokes' old seat. Good to have the three of you with us.
Thank you for having us.
And I want you all to join us tonight for the 5th anniversary celebration for the Alliance of Community Teachers and Schools. It'll be an evening of speakers and conversation about racial inequity and resilience in public education, what we can do about racism in our schools. I'll be moderating a conversation with Taylor Branch, Karen Weber, and Edward Fergus. It'll be a dynamic conversation. Come take part in it, 6 to 8:30 p.m. tonight. You can reserve a seat at actscelebrate.eventbrite.com. That's actscelebrate.eventbrite.com. That'll be on our website, but do join us, and we'll be taping that and airing it on our program hopefully next week. So good to have the three of you with us. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
We'll take a break. Time for national politics. What did you think about last night's VP debate? Or were you stuck with the Orioles? We'll see. Stay with us. Come back.